live from the DC studios
at Brightline Interactive.
Welcome to the VR and AR podcast,
brought to you by the VR and AR Association.
And now here's your host, Tyler Gates
and
Sophia Moshasha.
Well, I am Tyler Gates and I'm joined here by my co-host Sophia Moshasha. Sophia, how are you doing this afternoon?
Excited to be here, Tyler. We have two very special guests with us, Philip Perry, who's the head of technology for defense and security for CAE, and his colleague Chris Stellwag, who's the director of marketing communications for defense and security. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hi, Sophia. Hi, Tyler. Nice to be here.
Great to be here. Thanks.
So Philip and I actually met at ITSEC Paper Reviews this past summer, where we were on separate committees reviewing content to be presented at ITSEC, and so we're very excited to have him here today with us.
Yeah, Phil, thanks for taking the time.
Great, excited to have this chat, and actually my first podcast ever, so it's going to be
great. That's awesome. That's perfect. Well, we're happy it's with us. Yeah, and just to quickly recap that, Sophia was talking about ITSEC. That is some of our listeners may have heard us talk about that in the past, but that ITSEC is the largest training and simulation show in the world, and it's done in Orlando. Usually towards the end of December, end of November, early December. And it's put on by our friends at the National Training and Simulation Association and NDIA. And it is, if you are in the simulation space, which is what we're going to be spending the most time talking about today, if you're in that space and you haven't heard of ITSEC, then we encourage you to either get in touch with us or get in touch directly with NTSA, because it's a great way to get introduced to the market. And to find customers. So, without going more into that, Phil, if we could actually just start out, you know, we talked about this before we started recording, but we always like to try to tell the human story behind the technology. I mean, the work that you guys are doing at CAE is just so incredible, and most people don't get exposure to the type of work that you do. And so it's always interesting for us to figure out, how did you get there? How did you get into the position to be ready to, you know, to sort of be leading the industry in the way that you are inside immersive tech, inside CAE?
Okay, great. Well, let me just give a very brief history of the company, founded back in 1947 here in Montreal. So we just celebrated our 70th anniversary a few years ago. Originally, we were repairing avionics equipment for airplanes. And just 5 years into our existence, we were mandated with our very first simulator build back in the day before computers existed. You can imagine the challenge that represented. And we just grew out of that space and developed a whole suite of training devices. So really 7 years in flight simulation. And developing capabilities. Most civil airlines now in the world across dozens and dozens of aircraft platforms train on CAE full flight simulators, where they essentially get full certification before they ever jump into the actual live aircraft. So it's a one for one replica of the performance and the environment in which those pilots are exposed when they fly day to day. And it's so realistic; they get a one to one credit for every hour they spend in the simulator. They can put that into their logbook as being an actual flight hour.
Wow.
So that's the development we've been doing this now. For, as I mentioned, 70 years, really a dominant player in the market space, 70% plus market share of the civil flight simulator market worldwide. So a lot of immersive tech in the broader sense of a full flight simulator over the years. So fast forwarding now to just over the past 5 or 6 years, we started to experiment with VR capabilities and some of the COTS headsets were coming out. Whether that's HTC 5 or the HoloLens and other manufacturers, and really trying to figure out how we put that into a training delivery mechanism. And that was quite challenging, particularly on the civil side, because training delivery is quite prescriptive. So if you're going to add capabilities, you sort of have to have a definition and go to the regulatory bodies and figure out how you go about delivering that. On the defense side, where Chris and I work, we looked at the capabilities, but felt that resolution wise, we were facing that hurdle of visual acuity. That was, it's kind of great to sort of feel that you're inside a cockpit. If you can't read your instruments, it's kind of tough to teach somebody. So that was sort of, that was the constraining factor. And we said, well, one day we're going to come out with a, there will be a device that will come to market that's sharp enough where we can at last, you know, sort of, you know, hit that final technical barrier and enable student training on immersive tech as we know it today. So that's part of the capabilities we launched at ITSEC just last month.
Right. So tell us a little bit, Philip. Tell us about you. Tell us, how did you get into the space where you're able to be involved in such important programs?
I mean, my career spans now 33 years at CAE, not always in the same position, but as a young engineer, did sensor development, visual developments back when it was big, heavy iron, fridge size computing machine. So, as we discussed a bit earlier, Tyler, the notion of this large hardware centric infrastructure was very prominent in the 90s, where you had to do a lot of custom ASIC design, custom chip design, high speed, board designs. And so the pace of evolution back in the day was measured in, 3, 5, 8, 10 years. So it took a long, long cycles to get systems out, to optimize them. And still to this day, many of our customers look at a full flight simulator and say, well, if I'm going to be spending tens of millions of dollars for a full flight sim, the expectation is that would live for 20 or 30 years. And still to this day, a lot of full flights that we delivered 20 or 30 years ago are still out there operating. Of course, they've received tech refreshes since, but they're still out there working. So I got involved in the early generations of image generation, of database content creation, of hardware development. So it's been an integral piece of my professional career in terms of creating that immersive environment. And it's all great to have a replica of an aircraft that you're sitting in a cockpit, but if you don't have a good view of the outside world, it's not that immersive, right? So you have to be able to look out and see the airport and get all the details and be able to see the mountain ranges and everything else. And, that goal is almost, our desire ultimately is to be cinematic in quality, right? To be able to, not be able to know what the difference is between reality and computer generated imagery. So that's been, of course, a journey through the years. And as we've seen, graphics cards develop and, software techniques and shader technology develop, and we've just been on this constant progression and elevator of technology that's culminating in many regards with what we see now with immersive tech.
Yeah. Yeah. And in all of that, I appreciate all of that background. And you certainly are. I mean, we knew when we met, several months ago that you'd be perfect for this episode because we wanted to, what we want to talk about here is obviously we're talking about simulation technology and how immersive technology is just really, kind of an infrastructure buster. I mean, it really does change the way we think about doing simulation. Really, what both you as an individual as well as at CAE, you have existed prior to modern day immersive technology, modern day simulation technology, as we understand it in the business context. And so you've operated inside a business context that predates immersive technology where simulation was the main focus and still is.
Yep.
And then
yep.
Now at CAE, you are in a position of leadership where you're witnessing firsthand and are a part of firsthand these programs where you're now leveraging immersive technology for a variety of reasons, which we'll get into. So mm-hmm. I just wanted to kind of, for our listeners, what we get the opportunity to do at the VR AR Association and at the podcast and just even with what we do in our day-to-day lives in working in this space, we get this front row seat to what's happening in the industry. And I think sometimes it's really important to sort of pause and step back from what's happening on the front lines and understand what this means and what's happening and to call attention to what's happening so that other people who are tangentially involved in this industry see from the sort of epicenter that there is major change afoot. And what specifically what we mean by that is The idea of immersive technology, even for the reasons that you just called out, Phil, in terms of having scenarios, simulations be believable, there is a difference between graphic realism and believability. And we all, you know, in the space, we know that believability is contributed to by, you know, lighting engines, physics engines, how things move, how things operate inside a space, not just the graphic realism. So there's a lot that we fully understand about how immersive technology delivers on believability, but what it's also doing is it's changing the costing. Because of the way immersive technology is delivered, it's delivered primarily as a software platform and does not require as significant of hardware systems as the systems prior predating immersive tech. And now I do want to call out, and I know that you all at CAE know this more than most, is that those old the large simulator systems, the large physical based simulator systems, they're not going away. In fact, what we're doing with virtual and augmented reality with immersive tech is we're augmenting the use of them. We're allowing pilots, things like pilots to be trained earlier on before they get access to simulators. We're allowing people to have sort of autonomous, unguided learning, and we're doing things that actually change the way simulation and training operate, enhancing the program. And so overall, what we're seeing happening is the cost is inverting, where you see a $14 to $18 million hardware spend on a large physical simulator with a fractional software relatively to that budget, a fraction of that budget being the software, that is now completely inverting, where the software cost is $8 to $10 million, and then you have less than $1 million in hardware. And what that does is it sets up a system for significant scalability. And I'm going to stop there, because what I would really like to do, Phil, is just hear from you, from your perspective, what was it like predating immersive technology in terms of in the simulation space? What was predominantly happening at a high level? What is the government asking, and how is CAE responding from a technology perspective?
Okay, good. I mean, that's very good. And I think you set that up well, Tyler. And let's look at, for a moment that full flight simulator space and understand that, you know, ultimately what we're trying to do here is bring the ultimate immersive environment to the air crew. And to do that, you need to replicate the aircraft. And the aircraft that are coming out, with every generation are becoming far more software centric than earlier generations. And what that means is that you still do today, a lot of software development to simulate, to stimulate the avionics boxes, or to look at rehost capabilities, so that that what the pilot sees in the simulator is exactly what he or she sees in a live aircraft. And that one-to-one match is very important, because we can get into all kinds of situations of negative training and incorrect muscle memory and all kinds of factors there that could be detrimental and even cause potentially an accident if they were not taught correctly to execute the right procedures. But certainly, you're right. We've seen a tremendous shift. I mean, as I mentioned, back in the 90s, we were using these big iron machines to render, you know, a VGA resolution picture. It's like, wow, that was, you know, it's kind of crazy. And today, the vast majority of what we do in terms of the visual environment simulation is all around software. It's all around content creation. It's all about, yeah, as you say, not just painting a pretty picture, but also for our customers, making a representation of the environment that allows, I think two factors. One, you get to be able to present it in a physics model. So whether you're looking that through infrared cameras, or looking that through NVG, or looking that with your radar system, or visually, that all that information is correlated. Now we have the additional challenge that our customers are also seeking to be able to network those simulators. So it's not just about simulator A getting that representation, but how do I network simulator B or C that could be a naval ship. It could be a remotely piloted aircraft. It could be a fighter jet. And each one of those platforms need to be able to see that environment in a perfectly correlated way, or else you're back to lack of fair fight issues, right?
Right.
And so that's, that I think is a a pretty significant factor when we think about the software and content investments that we make in terms of developments. Now, just coming back to that progressive transition, a number of years ago, we saw a definite trend towards using more flight training devices that didn't necessarily have motion on them, but one that had the highest fidelity in terms of mission training. Because when you think about it, when a pilot gets trained, he gets qualified or type rated or validated on a particular aircraft type, but then spends most of his or her career training to execute the mission, right? So there's far more hours involved in the mission training than there is in becoming type rated for that particular or, certified for a particular aircraft type. So having a dedicated device that was optimized for that environment is what we developed in a number of our higher end training devices. And we saw many customers saying, okay, that's great. It's great. It's smaller. It fulfills that mission footprint. But, government requests and services requests are coming in saying, well, could we have this deployable? Could we have this on the front line? Could we have capabilities that have the same level of sophistication and mission training capabilities, but could I deploy it in theater where the warfighter is fighting so that they can practice that mission, say a few hours before they go out and fly it. And that's a pretty powerful thing if you can create that immersive environment. I think immersive tech has the potential now for us to bring that mission training capability right out at the edge where crews are deployed and accelerate the turnaround time. I think if I bring it back now to undergraduate pilot training, I think there's an opportunity with immersive tech to really solve a key customer problem, that of pilot shortage. And some of your listeners may know that there is a sustained and growing issue with regards to pilot instructor shortage worldwide. It's right. True in the U.S. It's as prevalent in pretty much every other country that we deal with internationally. And to address that, you need to say, hey, how can I get pilots out faster? That's what the U.S. Air Force wants to do. That's what most Air Forces want to do. I want to get them trained faster. I want that cycle time to be shorter. I want the footprint of the training capabilities to be hopefully, less expensive than they were. Fewer demands, of course, if you have constraints on instructors, well, you sort of constrains how many pilots you can train, right? So if I'm going to have an optimized pilot to instructor ratio, I'd have an advantage there of being able to say, hey, that key resource that I don't have, I don't need as many of them for a given amount of pilot throughput. So I think immersive tech is a key enabler to be able to have a more self-paced training environment where the young pilots can learn on their own, can acquire the knowledge initially through an app-type environment to be able to practice and to hone their skill sets in flying, in this case, and doing that with audio feedback, with assessing your performance live. So it's not purely unguided. It's structured in a way that, hey, the more hours I spend in this training device, in this immersive tech training device, the better I get. So I'm not developing bad habits. And finally, sort of progress and validate that performance on a full flight simulator, full mission simulator, even a live aircraft. And that certainly remains a key aspect to any military training program, is ultimately the validation on the live platform as well.
Yeah, and you perfectly made the transition. You have training technology, simulation technology that predates modern day virtual and augmented reality, and then 2012, 2013, 2014 happen, and all of a sudden people get introduced to immersive tech. At the beginning, we're just calling it virtual reality. People are generally confused between VR and AR. So there's a bunch of stuff that's sort of happening at the very beginning there. But then quickly what happens is, as people's awareness grows with what it is in the first place, our listeners have heard me say this before, but I often say that, people understand a new thing through the lens of an old thing. And so we were starting to understand this new thing, which was immersive technology, through the lens of the old thing that it came out of, which is predominantly most people's understanding of virtual and augmented reality comes out of video game technology. And that is, it's incredible when you talk about it from a simulation perspective, but it can also be very limiting in terms of the actual true potential and capability of a new thing like immersive tech. And what what we have noticed over the last couple of years is the migration from using or being interested in the technology because it's new or because it's a popular technology with a younger demographic. These sorts of reasons are kind of initial reasons why people start to test and kind of play around with immersive technology. But now the state that we're in kind of now is people are now just starting to recognize and some of our customers, and I'm sure your customers as well, are starting to recognize that in a big way that there is a major efficiency play with immersive tech. Because of all the things that you just mentioned, and I know what you're talking about, we'll get into it a little bit. You're describing feature sets on your products. You've built out those feature sets because of the demand in the market. And the demand in the market overall is we want the training, but we want it faster. We want it more relevant to the actual scenario. We want it believable so that it generates mm-hmm. comprehension. And then we want, as you're saying, things like, we want to be able to do new things with the training that we can't do mm-hmm. in our older systems or our current systems. And those new things are things like dynamic eye tracking and being able to understand what the user is intending to do with their decision making and what stress levels are and cognitive load and doing all the things that used to be tracked from a subjective observation only perspective. Now we're actually objectively tracking that data and not just tracking it, but now actually taking that data, cross-referencing it with other data points that are collected in real time in the simulation, and then using that data to better inform the simulation in real time. And that transition from heavy hardware simulators to all of a sudden immersive technology in the, 2011, let's say, to 2013, 14 space, when it is just kind of coming out, to 2020, now we're in full swing, and we are, in a lot of ways, we believe that we have advanced really quickly, but, I have a feeling that a year from now, we're going to blow ourselves away in terms of how fast and how far we move collectively in the industry.
Yeah, that's good. And, Tyler, you touched on a point with regards to, capturing data and performance metrics of the students, as they come through these devices. And I'd like to touch on a point I think that would be quite relevant for the audience.
Please.
About a year ago, ITSEC 2018, we brought to market, to the defense market, a product called RISE. RISE stands for real-time insights and standardized evaluation. That's the acronym RISE. And what it really is it captures the performance of the student as they're conducting a particular maneuver in the full flight simulator, potentially even a live aircraft, but in a full flight simulator. And it measures that performance based on their speed of response, how well they've been able to control the aircraft with regards to flight, angle of attack, descent rates, a multitude of factors that you can then bound and saying quantitatively, a correct landing should be done this way. That's sort of the golden landing, right? And then you can measure the students and say, okay, you performed well. You were within that envelope of performance. And this other individual here was not. And we've integrated that in our traditional full flight simulators, as a means of assisting the instructors. The instructors, you just imagine how complex flying a modern day aircraft is. The instructors may have 30, 40, 50 things to look at. Above and beyond just a subjective assessment of how the crews are interacting with each other. And what we're really doing here with RISE is helping that instructor assess the student's performance. There may be many things. I mean, just pressing on the toe brake to 100% after they've had an engine failure and landed. I mean, that's, how can you really see whether they went to 100% or 80%? That's where capabilities like RISE allows you to capture that data and give insightful information to the instructor to say, hey, this student's good and this student's not, and this is why. And now I can track I'll go back and try it again and be able to capture that data and perform data analytics, because all that information is uploaded into the cloud and into a secure cloud. And then you can perform data analytics on it and say, wait a second here, why am I consistently getting failures on this particular type of maneuver? Maybe it's not the students after all. You know, it's funny. I tell my kids, you know, fail an exam in your university course and shame on you. If everybody fails the exam, then shame on the teacher, right? Yeah. So you really have to think that it's not just necessarily you as a student. Maybe it's the overall training program, which needs to be questioned. And by doing that larger data analytics, I know we're getting a little bit outside of immersive tech here, but you know, performing that data analytics is an opportunity to look back and have continuous improvement on your training program. And that's just as important as, you know, the optimizations and efficiency we can get out of self-paced training and leveraging immersive tech. But really, we have to touch on all those bases, if you will, to really accelerate that delivery of pilots that so many of our customers are looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, listen, I love that you bring up things that are outside of the immediate realm of immersive tech, because, you know, we often say that immersive technology is really just the visual engines of the actual data. It's a way for us, you talk about the amassing all of this data. And it's not that in a more traditional sense or simulation technology prior to that predates immersive tech. It's not that technology didn't necessarily produce the right type of data. It didn't possess the capability to visualize it in a way that it was meaningful. And so we may have had you have information about specific information about the aircraft in flight, and then you have information about, let's just say, an aircraft carrier that is in motion, and we have the data points, we have weather conditions, we have awareness of historical flights and what has happened during landings in those cases, and we have pilot training information and proficiency of pilots. So all of the data exists around even being able to predict accuracy of capability. But there's no way to actually visualize that information in a comprehensive way using two-dimensional technology. And that's really where immersive technology kind of steps up the game, because now all of a sudden we have this way to completely contextually visualize all of the information that is relevant to the training all at once. And so now you don't have to break it up between, let's first do the procedural documentation and then let's put you in a mod aircraft so that you can understand the cockpit. And then let's have you do video-based trainers to get the visuals down. And then let's have you do an overall assessment, and then we'll do a test flight. And, you know, that process takes a long time, and you have to step through a variety of different modalities in terms of learning mechanisms. And so it requires that the user is actually doing a lot of brain, they're doing a lot of brain work. They're translating a lot of information in a lot of different forms, all to sort of comprehensively understand the training material to perform well in actual scenario. And so immersive technology just does this giant consolidation effort of all of the information.
Tyler, you're quite correct. I mean, if we look at a traditional training program delivery, there's a large segment of that that's done sort of what we call the classroom environment, right? I mean, it could be as simple as the instructor up there explaining how the system works, or it could be running through some computer-based training programs to acquire the knowledge and skill sets. But ultimately, that has not been, other than the full flight simulator, has not been an immersive environment. And certainly what we believe is by creating a much more broadly accessible immersive environment, such as the Sprint Trainer that we demonstrated and launched at ITSEC here just last month, is an environment where, hey, now I've got an environment where I can see all that capability, I can see that environment, I can actually feel the vibration or the force on the stick, or I can hear the sound of my engine run up. I can reach out and control all the avionics that I would in the aircraft, but I do it virtually. So I use, you know, you mentioned earlier sort of the leap motion capability, so I can go out and touch the buttons. The simulation systems are still there. They're the same simulation systems we have from the high end. But instead of having only a single full flight simulator, now you have 12 or 15 of these VR trainers, where students are spending a significantly larger proportion of time interacting, flying that system and learning that skill set. And what's really great is that we've gone in and we've instrumented all those systems in a way, much like I described RISE a bit earlier, where we're instrumenting the student's performance as each one of them is progressing. So you as an instructor can now come in and say, hey, let me look at how John is performing. And John's progressed well, but he has a certain number of weaknesses. So you could then quickly identify that there may be remedial action that you have to send John back to learn or review a certain number of chapters in his training program so John doesn't fail the program. And that's something that many of our customers see today. There's a washout rate that is not zero. Right. And a student that goes through an entire training program just to fail the course is a huge cost and burden to the government. But even more so, it's like, well, that's a slot that we could have had a pilot flying, and now it's an empty seat, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, zeroizing the attrition is critical because if it's possible to do. And this is what you're suggesting, but it's possible to do because the technology is able to measure enough data points to actually help predict those scenarios, before they happen, so that we can take remedial action even with that particular trainee. So the way to zeroize attrition is we can zeroize it by, let's say, making the training technology more appealing, which definitely is true when we talk about immersive technology. You talk about an experience that, because it's more believable to the human brain, it's more enjoyable from an entertainment perspective. Therefore, we know people are just naturally going to want to train in these environments more often. So that's one way to attack the problem. The other way, though, is to actually use the benefits, the capabilities of the technology for the sake of the tech, which is use our capability to measure the individual's performance inside the training simulation to then be able to predict how we may, how that particular user may have challenges down the line that in traditional systems, may actually, create a scenario where that trainee either loses interest or just is unable to proceed because the type of training is more of a one-size-fits-all methodology, whereas immersive technology allows us to completely
adapt.
Yeah, to adapt and have it be highly personalized, yet at the same time, in a method that helps companies like ours scale, is that we don't have to sacrifice global scale. We can have personalization and scale in the same product, which again, historically hasn't been possible, which is just what makes immersive tech so much more attractive.
Yeah. And the creation of these devices where students are in their own device or on their own training device for many hours in a day allows them to progress at their own pace, to be able to rehearse again and again that skill set, also a data set that becomes very, very rich. And exactly as you say, by running that through deep learning algorithms and artificial intelligence, you may be able, back to the example of John, you may be able to identify that John is at risk before anybody else knows. And you can then take action and reduce that washout rate. One other dimension here that I think is quite interesting is the gamification of the training environment. You talk of the opportunities of the engagement, how engaging this training is. A lot of the students that are going through these programs love the idea of being in an environment where they can fly. They have a passion for flying. So being able to fly a training device where they're spending 8-10 hours on it is great. And let's leverage their alpha personalities and make a share the performance of each of the students in the class. And guess what? The students are going to go in off hours just to prove they can be tops in their class. And that's great because it's all about getting through the program faster, right? So if you could use use their personalities to help expedite that training delivery, that I think is a pretty powerful thing. And they enjoy doing it. So I think that is all sort of a key enablers of immersive tech and the ability to create that self-paced learning environment where they can progress at their own pace.
Yeah.
So Phil, looking ahead, I know you guys invest a lot of R&D internally to spearhead the progression of simulation technology. Can you talk a little bit about what's next in your innovation pipeline?
Well, yeah, certainly the rollout of the CATRAX Academy and the Sprint VR training device. And, you know, that covers those three pillars of the training continuum. And let me just briefly talk to those. It's the learn, practice, and perform segments of training delivery. And very quickly in the learn phase, it's like, how do we make it interesting for students to be able to learn at their own pace wherever and whenever they want? Well, let's think of, you know, an app environment. So a tablet-based app where they can anywhere, they can access that courseware, they can go through, they essentially acquire the early knowledge around a fuel system, a hydraulic system, electrical system, flight dynamics, all the capabilities. The knowledge component is what we want those students to acquire during those early phases. Then they can move on to acquiring the skill set. Part of that is to be able to visualize a particular maneuver with an audio track that guides and tells them what they need to be able to look at, so they can put on a sort of a COTS headset. And playing that off of a gaming laptop, they can visualize it and sort of rehearse what they need to do when they actually get into the training device. And in the central phase, the practice segment, it's that VR trainer I described a bit earlier, the Sprint VR trainer, where you get you get haptics feedback, you get force feedback on the stick, you get a full interactive cockpit and a simulation that's true to the actual aircraft that you're simulating that we've been doing for many, many years, but applied now in that VR environment. You know, 2020 Acuity headset, bring all those pieces together in a way that allows them to acquire the vast majority of that skill set proficiency before moving on to the final phase, which is really perform. And by perform, we mean spend time one-on-one with the instructor, ensure the students have acquired all that skill set and that they're proficient and ready to move on to the next phase of training. So, Sophia, I guess the answer here is rolling that out. You know, that capability has been brought to market. Now we're many of our business development teams are out there discussing with customers, see how we tailor it to their specific platform. Is it a T6? Is it a PC21? Is any other number of training platforms that could be applied to this? So I think the focus really now over the next year is going to be rolling out that capability.
Something that I think is really important about what you guys are doing and how you're responding to the market strategically is that you've spent the time. Obviously, you have, you personally and CAE has a significant amount of experience that predates immersive, like we've been talking about. And so you know, you've seen the market, you've seen what works and what doesn't. You obviously overall understand the business scenario around the inversion of cost. And how to build a simulation technology and a product that understands the learning environment. You've talked about it a lot, about autonomous learning, and this is one of the major infrastructure changes that immersive technology brings to the learning environment, to the idea of learning, is that learning can be done on a more sort of regular basis all the time, because you can have access to these training tools that you can pack into a backpack, or in the case of Sprint, I mean, it's still a very small, relatively speaking, a small packageable product that is easy to ship, which is a really, really important piece of this. And then you've put together a product that is leveraging the industry's best technology. And a lot of, you know, some of our listeners know because they've listened to the podcast before, but we've had Vario on the podcast a couple of times, and you guys are using Vario's head-mounted display, which is by far the best in the industry from visual acuity, eye tracking. It also allows you to do full articulated finger tracking in front of the head-mounted display, which is what you're talking about. You know, when you're reaching out and grabbing the stick and feeling vibration, you're able to do that without having gloves on your hands or any sort of external sensors. And so the way that you guys have designed the product is also just really, really smart towards the industry, which again is why we wanted to have this conversation, because it's just really important overall that the industry, that our listeners, that the industry overall understands that what's happening with immersive technology is not just a next iteration of training or a next iteration of communication. It is a significant, I would even say it's an exponential leap forward. And a lot of times what happens is when we have communication structures, we have a communication structure, and then around that communication structure is built a bunch of scaffolding, I would say, that is just sort of it's sort of constructed around the communication medium as bridges out into the real world. And we need to set up these scaffolding systems because there are limitations with two-dimensional technology. And then all of a sudden, when we remove the building, and instead of we take out two-dimensional technology and replace it with spatial technology, now all that old scaffolding implodes. And all of that old way of doing, of sort of mitigating for the fact that we don't have a spatial technology, all of that goes away, which honestly, it doesn't just disappear. It gets rolled into the capabilities of immersive technology, which is what allows us to deliver information faster through immersive tech. I mean, we're ingesting the information faster because we're using more of our full body system of sensors to understand that info, to place it into context. And then we're also learning that information in the original context. And so, for a lot of reasons, immersive technology is a significant leap forward. And it's important for people to understand that it's not just a movement forward, but it's also changing the way that we understand these industries, changing the way we think about the budgets, changing the way we think about training individual students. It's even changing the time frames. We think about training, and I Phil, I would be interested to hear from you on this, but we think, because you've talked about it a little bit, but we think about traditional systems of training because of the cost, because of the availability, it limits when we can train and when we can begin training. Yeah. Whereas with immersive tech, now we can kind of, and with what you're talking about with Rise, I mean, we're able to reach demographics before the traditional training times, which obviously just increases the overall pipeline.
Exactly. In fact, I've got to thank the folks at the U.S. Air Force AFWERX Pilot Training Next program for having really sort of opened many people's eyes into how we can collectively transform the way training is delivered. So just quickly on Pilot Training Next. So the AFWERX is a group that really does a lot of research and development, an incubator of sorts that looks at experimentation to find new ways of doing traditional training delivery in this case, and applying that technology to experiments. And they ran a number of classes and students through. They're at class number 3 now. I think they've graduated 2 classes through Pilot Training Next, and that makes extensive use of VR, of gaming technology, of student assessment. In the second class, there was quite a bit of data analytics came in with a virtual coach as well, and all that has sort of allowed and the successes and the research papers that have been presented on that have demonstrated that, hey, you can get a significant amount of training transfer in a non-traditional footprint. And I think that is that's pretty powerful. And I think that's what's allowed the likes of Sprint and Seed Trax Academy to be embraced by customers. We had a tremendous success at the ITSEC show with many customers coming in saying, this is what I've been looking for. And you know, now their leadership is saying, hey, we're now willing to do this because if it's good enough for the U.S. Air Force, then it's good enough for us. So let's bring that in. So I think you're quite right. We'll see an exploding amount of development, and adoption now over the next years. And, you know, I think it's important to highlight that it's not just about pilot training. And I've emphasized that a number of times, but if you look at whole crew training, there are so many other aspects of, it could be hoist operations, it could be door gunners. There's areas where, you know, the traditional footprint of the big simulator was really, really big because you had the entire back fuselage of a C-130. That's big.
Yeah.
Now, if you could do that in a sort of a VR space or even an augmented reality space, you could make that, bring that down and have students, as you say, embrace and use that technology for learning much earlier in their training delivery than what they were doing, historically.
Right.
So
They're measured. The whole time they're measured all the way through so that when they arrive at the, you know, quote unquote traditional time frame where they're going to begin training, they're now coming into that training with a significant amount of data arriving with them that is really, really helpful for training officers in terms of knowing how to teach to that trainee, knowing how to place them, knowing how to categorize and understand who are going to be the leaders in this class and who is going to need more assistance. Because again, if the effort is to zeroize attrition so that we can make sure that there are, you know, more pilots better trained in these cases, obviously, you know, as you mentioned, training simulation applies to any industry. But in this case with pilots, it's just more pilots that are better trained. And that's the overall goal. And that is achievable by reaching the students earlier on, allowing them to create self-generated data from their own desire to do the training simulation. And like you said before, flying is fun. And so for these sort of roles where people want to train, it is sort of a gold mine for the training organization because
and
the training operation.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And with that data, you're also going to be, with the new type of data that we're able to collect within the simulation now, you're going to be consistently setting standards and baselines and continuously updating those standards and baselines because of the real-time analytics that you're pulling off of there. Then you're going to go back and be able to better inform requirements coming out for training programs. And not only training programs, I would say in the future, it would be even the hardware of the actual, the airplanes that it's being built.
Yeah, the actual end product changes because the way we're training changes.
Yeah, I mean, everything.
It really is just overall the easiest way to sort of wrap all that up is to say that we are operating. Again, it's not that the data didn't exist before. It did. In a lot of ways, it did. But we didn't have a way to visualize it. We didn't have a way to visualize it, communicate it, comprehend it, and then test.
To mine it, to correlate it, to do all the sort of.
Exactly.
With the advent of deep learning algorithms, you don't necessarily have to look at this massive set of data with your own eyes. You can feed it to learning algorithms and say, look, tell me out of this pool of 200 students, these are the ones that succeeded. These ones are the failed. Tell me what it is through their entire training continuum. What are the aspects that need to be worked on so that the next time we come around and we optimize that training program, we can see about addressing those areas. That's a pretty powerful thing.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Well, Phil, Chris, guys, thank you so much for taking the time with us today. We really appreciate your level of expertise, your insight, your experience in the market, and really just the conversation. We certainly look forward to communicating again.
Great. Thanks for having us. Have a good day.
Well, I am Tyler Gates, and I'm joined here by my co-host, Sophia Moshasha, and this has been the VR-AR Association Podcast. We will be back soon.
This has been the VR-AR Podcast.
Brought to you by the VR-AR Association.
Thanks for listening.